It's time for the Ron and Brian podcast. Get ready to fill your ears with the latest news, politics, current events, and whatever else we feel like talking about this week. And now, your hosts, Ron and Brian.
All right. Good evening, everybody. It is Sunday night. It is 8 o'clock. It is time for episode 210 of the Ron and Brian podcast. Ron right here, joined as always by the very handsome gentleman to my left or right, depending on how you're watching this. Brian, how are you this evening?
As you can tell by my background, Ron, I am once again in corporate housing. There was a memo that was sent around to all the residents of my apartment building in Queens stating that there was an outbreak of monkeypox spreading amongst the residents of the building. They offered to put me up in this corporate, we call it corporate housing. It's really, a splendid penthouse apartment on Park Avenue. Why did my picture get smaller?
Not quite sure.
Really, Ron?
I was testing it. It just happened by itself.
Unfortunately, I am not in my home. It is, it's disconcerting when you are not near your things. You know, when told about a monkeypox outbreak, you do not have much time to collect your belongings. I took the things that were most important to me. I took my laptop. I took my microphone for my podcast. I took my Ron and Mrs. Ron stuffed animals. Okay, that was clever. I just grabbed what I could, but there's a lot of things I'm missing. I will, unfortunately, do not have a pair of pants for work tomorrow. We're recording this Sunday night. I will be having to wear the same pair of underwear because the laundry room in this apartment building is broken. So maybe I'll just hand wash in the sink or whatnot. I'll figure something out. However, it's, I'm not where I'm supposed to be. I'm not at home. So just bear with me, people.
But more importantly, before we get things into the main show, I think, Brian, you wanted to issue some apologies. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. First off, okay. I'm sorry. In episode 209 last week, I made comments related to sexual assault, religion, and other topics I should not have. I intended my comments to be funny. I thought they were humorous. In fact, they were insensitive and not reflective of the Ron and Brian podcast universe. I recognize that these comments were unacceptable and understand the insensitivity shown by my words. I recognize this and sincerely apologize for these comments. Instead of immediately issuing a public apology via the podcast social media, I waited a week. I listened. I read your emails. I listened to the voicemails left at our Ron and Brian voice line at 267-627-1062. I made a mistake, and I promise to think twice before making this mistake again. I will not make this mistake. And speaking of mistakes, Ron, there's nothing worse than neglecting to manscape during the summer months. The increased heat and humidity will play havoc with your crotch area, and you don't want to turn any potential lady suitors off with an unkempt pubic area. When manscaping, we have the right...
Quick moment. Did you just roll from an apology into a manscaped ad?
Well, the manscaped people said if I could get to the ad in the first 5 minutes of the show, they would pay extra. So I wanted to get right into the manscaped ad. Go to manscaped.com where we have the lawnmower 4.0 as part of the package. Use promo code RONSBALLS.
I'm afraid I'm going to have to cut the promo short this week. I feel it detracts from the sincerity of your apology.
Really?
Maybe you can do the live read next week. Maybe we can forego the Manscaped money one more week, and we'll address it during 211.
I worked very, oh, I thought you said you were going to, we were going to express that we're going to do that during 9/11. I was like,
We'll start preparing your apology for next week. In the meantime, let's really get into things with Drink of the Week.
Drink of the Week.
Na zdrowie.
Salud.
Drink of the Week.
Trancha.
Who's?
Drink of the Week. Drink of the Week.
All right, Brian. What are you drinking this evening?
Ron, it is summer. It is time for crushable pilsners. And this week, I'm going out to a brewery that just has a dear place in my heart. We're going out to the to Coney Island Brewing Company, where they make what they're referred to as the Mermaid Pilsner. I call it liquid gold, coming in at 5.2 ABV. It is a light-bodied, crisp-drinking, nicely hopped lager. A heavy-handed addition of rye malt adds a mild spiciness, which is balanced by a light, fruity, and floral hop aroma. So, Coney Island Mermaid Pilsner.
Very nice. I like the, looks like it's got a nice body, nice flavor to it. I think, can't remember if I had the Pilsner when I was out at Coney Island.
I am pretty sure you did.
All right. How is it?
Oh, just absolutely delicious. I've had this beer before.
Oh, great.
It is a solid go-to, one of my favorite summer beers.
All right. Excellent. Glad to hear
Ron?
Yes.
What are you drinking this week?
So yesterday, Brian, we were at the Great Chefs Philadelphia event for Alex's Lemonade Stand Foundation, this fundraiser they do each year. And I keep telling you, you need to attend. Like one of these days, you need to buy a ticket. You're going to need to come down. You're going to need to attend. So anyway, wife and I and friend of the podcast, Matt, went down to it. They had a beer garden there. And the good folks at Dogfish Head were part of the beer garden there. They had a new item that they were letting us sample. So I went out today and got a six pack of it. Brian, are you ready to crush it this summer? So if you are, the second beer in their off-centered art series has arrived. Mandarin and Mango Crush is a citrus-forward fruit beer brewed with boatloads of tart mandarin oranges and juicy Alfonso mangoes. With roots deep in coastal Delaware, the Crush cocktail has long been a go-to summer sipper for locals, and they're thrilled to have recreated an iconic beach town libation in the form of a craft beer. Clocking in at 6% ABV, the Mandarin and Mango Crush is a lightly sweet, hazy, gold-colored brew that boasts a refreshing, crispy tartness and a crisp, dry finish for a sip of summer in every bottle. And actually, I already had a few of these yesterday. I can already tell you, it's delicious.
So take a deep, let's look at that color of that beer.
It is
hazy.
Delicious. We talk about crushable, Brian. The crush is in the name itself. It is citrusy. You taste the orange. You taste the mango. It is light. It is refreshing. I may have to declare this the Ron and Brian beer of the summer.
And what kind of summer is this going to be, Ron?
What kind of summer? The only kind we have around here.
Hot podcaster summer.
Let me tell you sip that drink and you're going to make that noise, Brian.
Well, invite me down because I would like to try it.
All right. Sounds good.
Can you tell me more about this Great Chefs of Philadelphia that you went to? I imagine it was nothing but different people selling cheesesteaks, hoagies. I imagine there were some hoagies. I imagine there was some sliced pork with some broccoli rabe sandwiches.
30 top chefs from around the country, Brian, not just Philadelphia. You had chefs from L.A., Miami, New York City, D.C., all over the place. Even the cheesesteak was high end, Brian. It was a prime ribeye on a nice seeded roll with some Cooper sharp cheddar cheese, hot honey, and caramelized onion. I think my favorite dish of the night was a smoked prime rib tenderloin tartare. I mean, we were talking some high-end stuff and high-end drinks as well.
Now, is the food included or you have to buy it?
Is included. So you, for the one ticket price, which helps to go to Alex's lemonade stand, which raises money to help fight childhood cancers, all of the food and drink is included for the 3 hours of the event.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. You should come down.
Well, maybe next year I'll be, I will feel.
No water ice, just some high end. There was a little flan. There was a little custard. Someone made a nice lemon macaroon with a lemon curd filling. I mean, it was, again, high end top to bottom.
Well, high end. Okay. High end for Philadelphia is, you know, you've got to. You know, it not necessarily what is high end for what maybe I'm used to here in New York City.
No, of course, I get it.
I mean, how many people were shot at this event?
None that I know of.
And it took place in, was it inside the confines of the city limits of Philadelphia?
South. It's in the Navy Yard down by the sports stadium. So since a little higher security since it's in the Navy Yard.
Interesting. Now, if I do recall, you had mentioned in previous years that you had attended this event and there were live auctions.
There were.
That you had, I do recall there being a rift between you and your wife over the fact that you had bid a couple $1,000, if I'm not correct.
I think my highest bid was $6,000.
That was obviously pre-inflation pricing. So, I mean, you know, adjusted for 2022 prices, you're probably talking 18 grand at this point. But I think it was for a private chef to come and make a meal for eight.
It was 20. Thank you. 20.
20?
Yes. And you want to hear something interesting. This year, it was a chef for 16 people at his restaurant. Would you like to know what that went for this year?
I'm going to say $11,000.
$21,000.
Fuck out of here.
It was the second highest live auction of the day. Now, there was a trip to Italy for 7 days that someone paid $18,000 for.
Now, I have never been to an auction. And okay. You keep using this phrase live auction. Now, does that mean that they bring the item or they make the announcement, you're sitting in chairs? You have one of those little numbered fan things in your hand and you raise it.
But everyone is standing around and there is, you know, the guy is calling out the bids and you just raise your hand if you want to bid.
Now, what were some of the things that you I'm jumping the gun. Were there any things that you actually did bid on?
Not during the live auction. We bid on some things for the silent auction, but the live auction we did not because they were already starting higher. The only thing that was really interesting was a trip to Austin, Texas for the Austin Music Festival, where you would get airfare, hotel. You got to visit the Tito's backstage lounge and you got preferred seating. So, but that went for like $8,000.
Do you get to appear on the Joe Rogan Experience if you go down to Austin? Yes,
I believe.
Do you also get harassed by some of the famous homeless people that are in Austin?
That I don't know. I do believe you did get unlimited kombucha for the length of the weekend as well.
How many shares of Labor Smart were sold during the auction?
Millions. It was millions. One of the more popular pieces of the auction.
Some of the most worthless 100,000 shares that I own. 100,000.
All right. Well, in the meantime, Brian, let's keep this moving along here. Let's get to Beef of the Week.
Ron and Brian's Beef of the Week.
Brian, what's bothering you this week?
No, Ron, you go first. I always go first. This week, right. Ron, I want you to go first.
All right, that's fine. So my beef this week, Brian, is with influencers. As I mentioned, we went to the Great Chefs Philadelphia event yesterday with the Alex's Lemonade Stand Foundation. And that's, you know, Brian, I always say this, that's an event that you need to go to. You need to buy yourself some tickets. You need to come down. You need to attend the event. You need to make sure you have space for it on your calendar. Come down, attend the event. Anyway, And this was the first year I've had this experience where people were just literally being obnoxious with Instagram Live, taking pictures
really?
On social media, like, you know, knocking kids over, knocking the cancer children over because they're trying to like film their walk through the crowd, you know, blocking people getting food from the tables because they wanted to get that shot of the woman putting the little edible flowers on the one thing. It was absolutely annoying. It's like, it's a charity event. We're all here to have a good time. No one cares about your social media clout. You will notice sure. I did not post anything on our social media channels about it because I knew why we had bought tickets and why
and when you say we, you mean you and your wife. I did not have any tickets to this event.
You did not.
If I had, I would have attended.
You need to come down. Is
I would, you know what? Next year, let me know when it is. I will put it on my calendar. I will buy a ticket and I will follow through and attend the event.
Sounds good. Maybe we'll do a sponsorship next year. There's some attractive packages and it will help get the Ron and Brian word out.
Are any of those packages in our price range?
There is one I think we could probably make happen.
Really?
Yeah. We'll talk about it.
Valid question here, Ron. Can we get an answer?
Yes. She stayed for the entire event, actually. Because that's how much, and that'll tell you how good the event is and how much she loves it. She did not cut out midway through. But Brian, more importantly, what's bothering you this week?
Amazon using third-party delivery services, specifically something called LaserShip. Oh. I don't know if you have experience with them?
Yeah, they're okay. The worst.
So I was out of town for about 10 days. And during that period of time, I had two packages that I had ordered from Amazon that I had expected to be delivered prior to going out of town. One was a set of headphones. One were some face masks, you know, with COVID, you know, the pandemic's not over yet, you know. Face masks still being required on New York City subway. So I placed an order for them. LaserShip. Yes, exactly. So both packages. And what I don't understand is why Amazon sometimes ships things through Amazon and other times they use this third party LaserShip. Both packages were attempted to be delivered after 9 o'clock on a Friday.
Right.
At a business address.
All right. That doesn't make a lot of sense.
Then they claimed that they tried to make another delivery the following day on Saturday.
At a business?
To a business address. Then they declared on Monday that both packages had been delivered despite the fact that neither actually had. They never arrived where they were supposed to. And I am currently fighting with Amazon to get refunds for those products.
Sons of bitches.
But so my beef is with Amazon and the fact that I still use them personally. I need to take responsibility for that one. But also just the fact that LaserShip is really my beef of the week and Amazon for using them.
I think that's valid, Brian. We will allow that this week.
Thank you.
Sure thing. To get into the news, Brian, if you don't mind me saying, we should probably start since a large portion of our last couple of episodes has been with the gun violence permeating the country over the last few weeks. Let's talk about gun legislation that appears to be heading to Congress, a deal that was brokered with Senators Chris Murphy from Connecticut and John Cornyn from Texas that seems to have be gathering some bipartisan support. Brian, have you seen any of this legislation yet?
Not yet. Walk me through it.
So here is the main points of the legislation. It would provide major funding to help states pass and implement red flag laws that will allow law enforcement to temporarily take dangerous weapons away from people who pose a danger to others or themselves. Would give billions in new funding for mental health and school safety, including money for the national build-out of community mental health clinics. It would close the boyfriend loophole so that no domestic abuser, a spouse, or a serious dating partner can buy a gun if they are convicted of abuse against a partner. The first ever federal law against gun trafficking and straw purchasing. This would hopefully make a difference. A straw purchase? Would you like the you stuck on that?
I assume that's when you make the purchase in your name, but you're giving it to somebody else.
Boom, you got it. So again, hopefully stopping the flow of illegal guns into cities with that.
I did a lot of straw purchases for Labor Smart Shares back in February. of 2021. I know that it's a long hold, understood, but I did a lot of straw purchases.
You know the danger of them then. Enhanced background checks for under 21 gun buyers and a short pause to conduct the check. Young buyers can get the gun only after the enhanced check is completed. And then clarification of the laws regarding who needs to register as a licensed gun dealer to make sure all truly commercial sellers are doing background checks. So this supposedly has the support so far of 10 Democrats and 10 Republicans. The Republican support being important in that with 10 Republicans, if all Democrats get on board, that would provide the 60 votes needed to avoid a filibuster against this bill. Brian, your initial thoughts on this legislation?
It's not enough.
True.
It doesn't go far enough. It's a sad statement of the country that we live in, that this is considered something radical in this country, that we have some type of legislation being proposed with bipartisan support to make it tougher getting your hands on guns. I would like it to go further. I mean, everything that's listed as part of this bill makes sense to me. I agree with all of it. I wish that we were in a position where we could go further and put some real stranglehold on the proliferation of gun violence in this country.
And I think that's a lot of the early feedback from people is it doesn't go quite far enough. However, it would be the most substantial piece of gun control legislation passed in this country in the last 30 years. So I guess you can look at it as a start. To hopefully something, you know, if we do see positive results from this legislation, hopefully something that would continue to tighten up and get, you know, get even stricter moving forward.
I'm all in favor of it. I would vote for it in a heartbeat, you know, even though I know that ultimately they're trying to come for our guns.
Right. I mean, Obama may still come back for our guns.
And he's an alien and one of the lizard people.
All right. That's a good way to look at it. Also this week, Brian, the January 6th committee was meeting in prime time. Rarely do these committee meetings take place in the evenings, but I guess they wanted to make sure that people that wanted to watch these proceedings could. How much of the January 6th committee viewing did you watch?
It was riveting. I watched several hours of the primetime coverage. I believe it was Thursday evening. Invited some of my neighbors over for it, made popcorn. I made sure that I invited some of the people that were on the right. I invited some of my more liberal friends. You know, I feel like what's great is that we're getting to the truth in a way that people can't contest the motives of what's going on. You know, it's just, it is a clear, fact-finding mission on what took place that day. And I believe that in the end, it's, you know, the people who are culpable for the unnecessary loss of life that took place that day will be held accountable.
Hopefully, you know, and there was some new facts and information that were revealed during the beginning of these hearings. There was some video footage from police body cameras, the Capitol hallways, and office footage that had not been seen previously. excuse me, as bad as the attack looked, you know, from the initial reports that we saw, seeing the footage, especially from the police body cameras, showed just how violent it was. It was more than just a destruction of property. There was a lot of physical violence imparted upon the Capitol Police and other police officers that were there.
Are you sure that this was body cam footage from January 6th? Because, you know, from what I've heard, you know, this was just really, peaceful Americans that had gathered in the nation's capital to basically speak out against the stolen election. You know, my understanding is that some people did get into they got into the Capitol, but there wasn't a violent crowd. They were walking peacefully, taking photographs of themselves inside the Capitol as like any normal tourist would have. I'm surprised that you are categorizing this as an action of violence almost.
According to, you know, Washington Commanders head coach Jack Del Rio, he called it just a dust up. But this videotape and radio communications are proving differently. Other things that came out so far, Trump's Attorney General Bill Barr telling investigators in his on-camera deposition that he told Donald Trump that his allegations of election fraud were, quote, bullshit. Ivanka Trump also said that she accepted what Barr had to say, quote, I respect Attorney General Barr, so I accepted what he was saying. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, said Vice President Mike Pence was being direct, wanting military help at the Capitol. However, the response from the White House was that Trump was in control and did not want outside forces to come in and help. Liz Cheney said Representative Scott Perry of Pennsylvania and multiple other Republican congressmen sought presidential pardons for their roles in attempting to overturn the 2020 election. There were texts between Sean Hannity and then White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany revealed. For former campaign advisor Jason Miller said on camera that he told Trump in pretty blunt terms that he was going to lose. And then a ton of Proud Boys and Oath Keepers on camera saying that they went to the Capitol that day because they believed that's what Trump wanted done. They felt he'd asked them to do it. And then after Trump's stand back and stand by remark in a debate during the presidential elections, membership in the Proud Boys tripled.
No way.
Yeah. So the committee really went after Trump, talking about his ineffectiveness and defusing the situation, painting him as a kind of a rogue and dangerous president. And so, you know, now a lot of people are feeling that the testimony and the information provided in these committee hearings so far are really teeing it up for the DOJ to be able to bring charges, bring an indictment against Donald Trump regarding the January 6th events.
Well, I, to me, the whole purpose of all of this is to attempt to smear him in his preparations for running for president again in 2024. I think, you know, it may not be the on the surface reason for all these committees and actions and whatnot, but I think there is a large percentage of the establishment that is terrified that he is going to run again in 2024. And because the Republican Party is in the state that they are, that being Florida, are afraid to put any type of opposition to him in terms of running against him in the primaries.
Right.
So I think that this is, you know, how bad can we make him look? And responsible, and how can we make him look, give the public a perception that this is not somebody you want back in the White House?
Well, and I guess that's the question is, will enough people that would support and vote for Donald Trump actually, number one, watch these committee hearings, and number two, believe the allegations against him? I mean, I guess at the end of the day, you just really have to convince, you know, that group of voters in the middle that can be swayed either way. And that's who they're really targeting at this point.
Yeah, that's you know, the impression I get is that you've got, you know, you've seen some cracks in the Republican Party. You've seen some people who are positioning themselves to be a potential candidate in 2024. But there is still such fear in the Republican Party to take a stand against Trump. In a way that I've not seen politically in this country in my lifetime.
Yeah, it's the cult of personality that continues to be willing to debase themselves and go against, you know, just common human decency to
even their own best interests.
Right.
Even their own best interests. Like, even like, I mean, like, not to dredge up, you know, yesterday's news, but I mean, like, you know, even, you know, at the peak of the COVID pandemic, obviously not the first wave, which was in New York, where with the refrigerated trucks for the bodies, the forklifts, taking the body bags out to the refrigerated trucks.
All that.
But even while the South, you know, got hit with Delta during, I guess it was the summer fall of 20, you know, you had, you know, Donald Trump was actively taking steps to downplay the severity of this disease that was killing his own followers, and his own followers were like, yeah, this disease isn't serious. It's just like the flu. There's a 99 point something survival rate as they're going into the hospital with an oxygen level about 80%, and practically dying.
Well, and now clearly the pandemic is over, Brian, because today, officially, international travelers coming into the United States no longer need to test to show that they are COVID-free to enter our country.
So, what's your thoughts on that?
I guess at the end of the day, what, you know, how effective are these rapid tests that people are able to take anyway? So, you know, when we traveled in March to the Bahamas, I mean, obviously, you know, we had to test prior to going and test while we're down there. But again, it's just the nasal test, the swab, you know, which has a limited, you know, effectiveness. And, you know, we could have easily been asymptomatic and not have had COVID strong enough for the test to pick it up. So at the end of the day, you know, how long can you continue to test for this?
That's kind of my theory. It's the fact of, you know, the numbers that I'm really following nowadays are not the positive cases, but really the hospitalizations and the deaths and the death rate. And those numbers consistently have been very low, you know, relatively speaking, throughout this calendar year. I know Omicron, hit its peak, I think, December into January this past winter. And, you know, the positive cases were outrageously high. But the truth was that there was no corresponding, serious increase in number of hospitalizations. The death rates weren't that high. And I think at some point you do need to start, you know, treating this as the disease that it is currently and not the disease that it was 2 years ago. Right. So I'm not really all that concerned about them taking down that, travel requirement. I'm more concerned about the current rise in the price of gasoline how our current administration is really taking no active steps in doing it. And also, I was reading an article on, I believe it was the Drudge Report link somewhere. And once I'm on the Drudge Report, it's a wormhole. I don't even know where I'm on the internet on anymore after that. But the article was basically stating that Saudi Arabia is actively taking multiple steps to ensure that the price of oil stays as high as possible to prevent Biden from from being seen as a effective president. They're doing, Saudi Arabia is cutting the supply. They are raising the price. They're not negotiating They're not negotiating good faith with Biden right now in terms of oil, because they know that if the price stays high, the American people will vote him out in 2024. Mm-hmm. And the Saudis have never seen a president as friendly to them as Trump. So to the Saudis, they want Biden out. They want Trump back in. So it is an attempt by the Trump, by the Saudis, to actually ensure that we keep paying a lot for gasoline at the pump, which is one of the reasons why I have decided to buy a Tesla. I'm going with an electrical car. That'll be my next purchase. I've already started saving for an electrical car. Elon Musk will be my Lord and Savior.
Fair enough. But the interesting thing, Brian, is that even though the cost of oil continuously has been increasing per barrel, the cost of gasoline has gone up, you know, exponentially versus the cost of it. I mean, you've got these gas companies that, yes, they're paying more, you know, for barrels of oil, but they're also bringing in record profits at this point.
Record profits. Yes. No. The idea that there is any type of direct tie between a genuine price of a barrel of oil and what is being paid at the pump is ludicrous. I mean, to me, once they opened up the price of oil to as an investment vehicle, you've got people on Wall Street that are buying and selling oil options, driving prices higher and lower, and it's just it is all over the place. The price that you are paying when you put gasoline in your car, the odds that Joe Biden has anything to do with it is ludicrous. And I'm not saying that he's innocent, and I'm not saying he's an effectual president. I'm saying there's so many other factors going on right now that are that to me are just have to do with corporate greed, that have to go have to do with really just fundamental issues with the American economy that have existed long before Joe Biden became president. It's not a shocker that you pump trillions of dollars into the American economy in a short period of time, and suddenly you've got prices rising. You know, you add the supply, you know, the dollar is worth less, so it's going to cost more to do it what you were able to do before. Just, you know, the idea that one person, even if they are the president, has the type of power to control this is ludicrous.
Well, I think one of the challenges is that business has outgrown the restrictions that government can necessarily put on them, unless, you know, Congress is willing to enact laws. And yeah, I mean, Congress attempted to, put a price gouging law into effect for gasoline, and it was blocked because every single Republican voted against it.
Right.
You know, I think a lot of the issues that, you know, we are seeing in this in our economy right now is due to the fact that, you know, corporations and the wealthy control a lot of these things that impact, you know, all of us today. Like the housing crisis right now, you know, a lot of that is due to the rollback of some of the Dodd-Frank Act during the Trump administration. It used to be when, you know, houses went on the market, you know, investment companies had to wait 14 days before they could put an offer on the house to allow the general public to be able to, you know, purchase homes. Now you've got it, you know, where it's when they go on the market, like Goldman Sachs, you know, is purchasing entire communities. Just to be able to flip them into rentals versus actually people moving in and, you know, having equity, creating generational wealth. One of the biggest ways that we as a country have passed wealth from generation to generation is home ownership. Mm-hmm. That's another thing that's slowly being stripped away from the average American. We got all serious there.
We got depressing too.
Also, just real quick, to your point about the hospitalizations. So we are seeing a bit of a bump up since April, but hospitalizations, to your point, only around 25,000 with 2,700 people in ICUs. You know, compare that with the peak in late January when we had almost 152,000 hospitalizations and 26,000 people. So again, you know, you have to start looking at COVID and putting those numbers against, you know, the flu or SARS or things of that nature. And, you know, again, it's not to not be taken seriously, but at some point, you know, is it at a level where, you know, most people aren't going to be impacted and we have to move forward on that?
Well, I think what really, I mean, to me are the steps that you are taking to prevent the spread of it, are those steps in line with the danger of the disease?
Right.
You know what I mean? Like Ebola right now is you know, it's killing percentage-wise way more people that get that contract it than COVID, but nobody is walking down the street worried about Ebola because the odds of it happening to them are small. So the odds of right now, when you think about it, the odds of the of our hospital system being overloaded by intensive care patients, relatively low right now. So I think we need to, you know, readjust how we're looking at it.
All right. Also taking place this week, the other day, Idaho police officers arrested 31 people believed to be affiliated with the white nationalist group Patriot Front after they were seen gathering near a pride parade in the city of Coeur d'Alene.
Mm.
Saying that correctly.
I once summered there when I was in college. I got a job working as a I was working as an intern at a white supremacist newsletter organization, you know, standard Nazi, you know, sympathizers,
of course.
You know, keep the races pure kind of messaging. I wasn't really in line with it, but I really wanted to go to, what was it, Fleur de Lis, Idaho?
Coeur d'Alene, Idaho.
Coeur d'Alene. I was frighteningly close. So Coeur d'Alene, I mean, it was just, it's Ron, it's so pretty during the summer. You know, the forests are just filled with, God's creatures, love is in the air, watching the teenage couples, taking their walks down Lover's Lane, the white nationalists, really drumming up support, for themselves in Coeur d'Alene.
Coeur d'Alene. Apparently
Coeur d'Alene.
31 of them pulled over in a U-Haul. All wearing similar clothing, bearing the insignia of the Patriot Front. They had shields, shin guards, other riot gear, at least one smoke grenade. The thought was that they were going down to disrupt the Pride Parade, and all of them were arrested for conspiracy to riot, which is a misdemeanor. All of the suspects coming from at least 11 states. Local police have called in the FBI to assist in this investigation. So okay. Kind of freaky, kind of scary.
So the crime was that they were planning on committing a crime.
Correct, which is why okay. It's only a misdemeanor.
Okay. But the important part is that they stopped the attack on the Pride Parade.
Correct.
And how many people in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho are participating in the Pride Parade? Like how big of a Pride Parade does Coeur d'Alene, Idaho get?
That I couldn't tell you. I don't have those statistics, unfortunately.
Like I feel like it's a guy named Roger wearing like a rainbow colored shirt and some very short shorts walking down the street.
You may be right. Again, I don't have the numbers to prove or disprove your theory.
I'm having a problem thinking like there's going to be, you know, tens of thousands of Pride fans walking through the main strip of Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. You know, well, they make good potatoes.
You stated how lovely Coeur d'Alene is in the summer. So
it's beautiful.
Maybe people that might go to a Pride march somewhere else, maybe they go to Coeur d'Alene because of how nice it is.
Mm, so beautiful. One of my favorite memories of that summer was sitting on my deck drinking my macchiatos in the morning, before I had to go to the newsletter to print up, hate messages.
Very nice. Brian, I want to get your take on this story. It's a weird news story, which we sometimes will save for after dark, but we're going to do in the main podcast here. So a Missouri woman who claimed that she caught a sexually transmitted disease when she had sex with her boyfriend in his vehicle has been awarded a $5.2 million settlement from her now ex's car insurance company.
What?
So back in February of 2021,
we spoke about this story before.
Well, haven't we? Because she just
I think finally, we spoke about the story when she sued. I did not. This is the verdict now. So you're telling me. My brain is all over the place right now. On earth is the car insurance company responsible for the STD of one of the for the driver of a vehicle?
So because the incident in question took place in this guy's vehicle and she in turn then, sued him, stating that, he gave her the STD. He knew of his condition. He knew of the risks of unprotected sex. He did not let her know. So an arbitrator found that the couple's sex in the vehicle directly caused or directly contributed to cause her HPV. So after the man was found liable, because it was in his car, the judgment of $5.2 million fell to his car insurance company.
But the car insurance company does not in any way ensure the overall health in a non-vehicle related manner of the people inside that vehicle. That's like me getting into a car with you and catching COVID.
But think of it this
Can
way.
Can I sue your insurance company?
Well, if you willfully run somebody down with your car and then you get sued, your car insurance company may be liable for the cost of your, whatever the damages are. If you run your car into somebody's house, your car insurance company is going to pay for whatever the damage you do. So I guess in this instance, this follows that chain of responsibility.
I would be appealing that in a heartbeat.
Well, the state court of appeals is the one who affirmed the multi-million dollar payout against Geico. So
doesn't even make sense. That doesn't even make sense to me. Why not sue his doctor while you're at it?
I mean, is it the doc? Well, again, I think it's less the responsibility of the car insurance company and the fact that it was damages incurred inside the vehicle. And again, I'm not disagreeing with you that it's not crazy. I'm just assuming that would have to be the logic that was followed for Geico to be on the hook for now $5.2 million.
Wait a second. So if I got HPV in a vehicle, I could collect $5.2 million?
If you unknowingly got it from someone who was liable, who should have told you that they had a disease and should have warned you about the risks of unprotected sex, then apparently so, yes.
I did that all throughout high school. At no point did I think of suing an insurance company.
I've got no answers yet. I found it hard to believe too, which is why I put the story on the list to cover.
It's just so bizarre. Ron, can I ask you a question?
Of course you can, my friend.
What are you watching?
What am I watching? So, I watched the latest episode of Obi-Wan, which
no was, spoilers. I haven't no started spoiler, it yet,
but it's good. I mean, I continue to enjoy it. It is keeping my attention. They give you a cliffhanger at the end of every episode, so it's very good. And I also watched the new docuseries called Keep Sweet, Pray and Obey. It is a documentary about Warren Jeffs and the fundamentalist church of Latter-day Saints and
Child
brides and everything else. Yeah, it's creepy as fuck. As bad. I mean, you hear the story about Warren Jeffs, and you hear about, you know, the polygamy and people having, you know, 23 wives and 83 kids and, you know, marrying underage children.
Sure. And the child abuse. Call it for what it is. It's child abuse.
So it's 4 episodes. You know, and it's again, it's not too long. I think this is one of the few docuseries that got the length of it right. And it's a slow build up to that 4th episode. And you find out at the end of the episode.
Didn't he flee at one point? Didn't he flee?
Oh, yeah. He was a fugitive from justice for a long time. And then they eventually caught him, and he went to jail for like 10 years. And then in Texas, where they had built this compound, like they ended up, you know, finding all these records and these audio and videotapes that he had done with some of these child brides. And that the last 20 minutes of the final episode is some of the creepiest skin crawling shit that you will hear. If you really want to understand how evil people can be in the name of religion.
Yeah.
Watch this show.
Okay. Brian, and what was the name of it again?
That's called Keep Sweet, Pray and Obey.
Okay. Speaking of that, I just finished Under the Banner of Heaven on Hulu.
And?
About the also about fundamental Mormons, brothers who killed their sister-in-law for violating what they felt was the role that a woman plays in the Mormon family. That was a 7-parter. I would say it probably should have been a 5-parter. Starring Andrew Garfield and Sam Worthington.
Would you recommend it?
I would highly recommend it. Yeah. Also, I finished Ozark, finally. Oh. I know I'm late to the game, people, but I finally finished Ozark. I wanted to hear your take on it. And I'm assuming everybody watching it has finished it, so we don't have to worry about spoilers.
If not, just jump ahead a couple minutes. I guess my takeaway is I did find it very unreasonable that the entire family was still alive at the end of the series. The fact that, you know,
this is based in reality. None of the the length of that you have to go as the viewer to accept that this is part of the story, and how implausible so many of the plot twists that took place during these, what was it, 5 seasons?
I think so.
Whatever it was. But I felt like it was one of those shows where they kept trying to keep the stakes high.
Right.
And they had done such a good job in the first season of setting the stakes high that it was almost impossible to keep the story realistic while at the same time keeping the stakes as high. Like, to me, they lost me when Wendy Bird starts the Bird Foundation. Like, it was just a ludicrous, like, somehow they were now getting involved in state politics and whatnot. I felt it. Well, you know, I did like the last couple seasons, the arc of the Ruth Langmore.
Yeah,
I did like her story arc. When she really starts out, she is as hick as they can get, and you have no idea. You couldn't predict how much of an impact she plays on the story, and in so many different ways, she is that moral compass,
right,
of the in the sense that you see the Bird family, even the children are messed up they are. I thought it was somewhat I was surprised that in the last episode, like, the whole family just gets back together again.
Right.
Like, yeah. Suddenly the son's just back in the fold. Right. like just out of nowhere, like within like a half a second.
It didn't make sense. It's one of those where there's not really, again, to your point, there wasn't a lot of like quote unquote good guys. You know,
no, nobody was good in the show.
And yeah, to your point, Ruth kind of had that character arc where, you know, she kind of became the good guy, you know, in her own way. And ironically enough, she's like one of the lone main characters that dies before the end of the season.
Sure.
Which that one was a tough one. That was tough. Oh.
Yeah, but you knew it was going to happen. You knew what I liked about it was that they didn't make it like a shocking, normally with Hollywood and these shows, they try to get you with the shock value. Like they would have had her killed and be like, oh, but they gave you about a 7 minute heads up. Yeah.
You knew
that the drug lord's sister was going to take Ruth out. And I did get a kind of a kick in the scene when Wendy and Marty are talking and Wendy's like, we can't let this happen. And Marty's like, well, I think we kind of have to let this happen.
Right.
And there's nothing we're going to do about it. There's nothing we can do about it. And it's just going to happen. And then they just kind of look at each other in silence. And it's just, you know, ultimately they were they're evil people. You know, and as much as you wanted to learn to like them, as you know, the story progressed,
and then you finally see at the end, really, as much as they tried to keep their kids out of the entire situation, by that last episode, their kids were as corrupt as
of course.
But I always hate like the fade to black ending bullshit. I don't know. That's my only thing. Like, you know, fade to black and then you hear a gunshot. Like, all right.
Sure.
It's very, very overdone. But
well, it raises the question, like, did the kid kill his father or did he kill the private eye?
Right. You're always going to have that question.
He killed the private eye.
So that was it.
Anything also, else? One other thing I did. I watched the new Ricky Gervais stand-up special on Netflix, Supernature.
What did you think of it?
I enjoyed it. You know, he does the one thing I think all comedians should never do, and that is laugh at their own joke. To me, there is something so disingenuous about saying something you have written, you have honed, you have practiced, you have repeated, and then getting on in front of an audience and laughing as if this is a new joke to you. Chappelle does it all the time, and it drives me, it irritates me, because it almost feels like it is the comedian's attempt to cue the audience that this is where you're supposed to give a big laugh, that if it's so funny that Ricky Gervais laughs at this joke, that you should really also be laughing along to it. It just, he does it, it annoys me. However, he had several really well-written jokes in there. You know, one of the things I've always respected about him is that he, you know, he doesn't pull punches. You know, he's comfortable making the audience uncomfortable. He's also comfortable, not sugarcoating things. You know, he has several jokes about the trans community. He has several jokes about other issues, you know, like the woke cancel culture. And he makes the point, and something I've always agreed upon, even when I have to fucking apologize at the start of an episode. But one of his things is, like, he says, I see myself as a comedian. I make jokes about things. It would be dishonest of me to say that I can make a joke about this subject and that subject, but I'm not allowed to make a joke about this subject because this one's about transsexuals.
Right.
And it's about transgendered people, or it's about the LGBTQ. He's like, I see the trans community. I see the LGBTQ community as being human beings, and they have the rights of everyone else. And because of that, I should be able to make a joke about them in the same way that I can make a joke about a straight person, or I can make a joke about, a Hollywood actor. I should be able to make a joke about a trans person and then judge me on whether the joke is funny or not. It's not coming from a mean place. It's not coming from a place of anger or hatred. It's coming from a place of I'm trying to make the audience laugh. And that resonated with me.
Okay. Oh, another thing I did, a couple other things I watched that I forgot. I watched Dirty Daddy, the Bob Saget tribute on
Netflix. Oh, that's already out?
That is already out. That came out on Friday. Great lineup. Chris Rock, Jim Carrey, Michael Keaton, Dave Chappelle, Tim Allen, Jeff Ross, John Lovitz, John Mayer, Jackson Brown is there, Seth Green, all the Full House. It is, I guess in watching the preview for it, I went into it thinking it was going to be more of kind of like a comedy special. But it was a very, like, it was a very emotional, very heartfelt.
Okay. Yeah.
And it was very tough to watch some of these people that are still, you know, suffering this loss of, you know, again, it was very similar to.
Well, it was also filmed literally within days of him dying.
This wasn't
a memorial months after, you know, he had passed, where time had, you know, healed some wounds. This literally was days.
Right.
I think this was the evening of his funeral.
They did a memorial a couple days after his passing, and then this tribute was about a week after that.
Okay.
But it was similar to the recent Norm Macdonald special, where they had all the comedians afterward talking about how much Norm Macdonald meant to them as a person, mm-hmm. and how good he was as a person. And that was kind of the big takeaway from everybody that they got on stage. And just, again, just an eclectic group of people that just loved Bob Saget. I mean, Jackson Brown hasn't been relevant in however many years, but apparently he and Bob Saget were best friends. And so it was a very, there are some laughs, but it's also a very difficult show to watch.
Was David Spade on it?
He was not.
It was either Bob Saget. There's a story that I've heard multiple times. It was either at the Saget Memorial or it was at the Gilbert Gottfried Memorial. And I'm leaning towards Saget because Spade is more of a West Coast person. But apparently the first couple people that got up to speak at the memorial received standing ovations when they were announced. And like Spade was like the third or fourth person to be announced. And when he got announced, nobody stood up to give him an ovation. And his opening line was, so I guess the standing ovation portion of the evening is over. I don't remember which one that is, but that was just a classic. To me, that's a classic Spade line.
There you go. I also watched Bill Burr presents Friends Who Kill.
How was that?
God awful.
Really?
God awful.
Why was it awful?
It was a huge lineup. It was Michelle Wolf, Jimmy Carr.
Did you say Wolf?
Michelle
Wolf. Isn't like a dog. Oh,
Wolf.
Wolf. I thought you said, I could have sworn I heard Michelle Wolf.
Jimmy Carr. Who else was on there? Jeff Ross and Dave Attell doing their bumping mics. That was the only good part of the special, was the two of them.
Really?
But even Bill Burr, I don't think was that great. And if you look at the reviews online, it's getting horrible reviews.
That's a shame.
I didn't watch the entire thing. I jumped ahead to see Ross and Attell. And so I would say do that. Go fast forward to Jeff Ross and Dave Attell, and then save yourself about another hour.
I feel like Bill Burr has lost some of his edge when he got popular. You know, when he was, you know, it's hard making that transition from being the angry, unappreciated celebrity to suddenly becoming recognized by your peers, by the industry. You know, he's the first comedian who's going to be headlining Fenway Park. He's playing, arenas and outdoor pavilions. Like, he's doing, you know, 10,000-15,000 seaters now. And it's very, you know, he also, and obviously this is now I'm bringing some of my personal stuff in here. But also when he got married and had a kid, suddenly, like, you know, I feel like he's, you know, what made him special was just how angry he was at society. And now he's this older guy who really does not have much to be angry about, you know. You know, anything he wants, he could buy right now. He wants to fly around. Yeah. He does, you know, he's in private jets. It's like, it's really hard to go from this underappreciated, you know, the thing that made him funny was sitting there, you know, listening to him complain about, you know, sitting in the middle of, you know, of the row in an airplane and the fat person sitting to his left and the lady on the right who was coughing. Like, that was funny listening to. And now it's like you listen to him and it's just, you know, he doesn't have any complaints, and he made his reputation on having complaints.
Right. No, I would agree. His, and even Jimmy Carr, who I usually love, you know, was, again, you know, his thing was all about cancel culture. And I think he was trying to be outrageous just to be outrageous. And like, he doesn't need to force it. Like, his material right. is usually edgy as it is. So him trying to just be over the top, just fell flat.
That's a shame. Because I had that on my list of things to watch.
Well, again, fast forward, watch Jeff and Dave Bell.
Can do and will do.
One story I did want to make sure, because we did want to have a discussion about this. So an Australian woman revealed how her long-term boyfriend blocked her on social media and ended up living with another woman while she was in a coma after an accident. Perth native Bree Duval was living in Canada with her partner of 4 years. 4 years. Put that mental note in.
Foreshadowing. We're gonna circle back to that 4 year period.
So she fell headfirst from a parking garage after a night out with friends. Always got to be careful in those parking garages.
It's happened to everybody. You know, I can't blame her. Who hasn't fallen headfirst off a parking garage?
This was back in August of 21. She was rushed by a helicopter to the University of Alberta Hospital, where she was placed on life support with a traumatic brain injury and multiple broken bones. She was in a coma for 4 weeks. Doctors said that there was just a 10% chance that she'd survive the catastrophic injury. Miraculously, she emerged from the coma, and then eventually someone gave her her phone back, and she found out that her boyfriend had blocked her on social media. And then she got a message from the woman that he ended up with that said to her, "I'm now with your former partner. I have moved him out. He is now living with me and my son. Please do not contact him."
All right, let's unpack this, people.
Yes, please.
You're in a 4 year long relationship with someone.
Correct.
You get into an accident.
Mm-hmm.
You are in a coma. Within 4 weeks, this guy has already moved out and moved on.
Correct.
He didn't even say, you know what? I don't feel comfortable living in our shared apartment. I'm going to, I need a place of my own.
Yeah. Mm-mm. Nope.
This dude moved in, instantly
picked up another family.
And not only that, and this is the bitch move in my mind, is he blocked her on social media.
Yeah.
Which is like, I mean, you're in a coma for 4 weeks, and this guy, if he didn't think you were going to survive it, if he didn't think that there was a chance you were going to pull out of the coma, why block you?
Right.
Why go through that effort?
Why go through that level of pettiness?
But this dude is petty.
So, but here then becomes the question I brought to you, Brian. You've dated someone for 4 years. They go into a coma. How long is it acceptable for you to wait until you move on to another person?
Socially acceptable, or are we talking about me based on my own personal past?
I don't know that I would base it on you, nothing personal, but maybe socially acceptable.
I'm going to say a year.
So a year, and again, if you're with somebody
for 4 years,
right,
in a committed relationship, and they are injured and in a coma, I think anything short of a year would raise eyebrows in my world.
Okay. Now, is the length of time different when it's boyfriend, girlfriend versus husband, wife? Or are you just saying it's a year regardless?
No, I think it's a year regardless. I think if you're with somebody for 4 years, I think the only discrepancy between you and a husband and wife is a piece of paper.
Okay.
You are, to me, 4 years is a committed relationship. It is us against the world at that point.
Okay. See,
what about you?
my thought, and I forget who told this to me one time.
It was probably your wife.
Now, this was many, many years ago. And someone told me that their theory was, and this was more with like your partner dying, but I guess coma can be somewhat similar.
Sure.
Is that for however many years you were with that person, mm-hmm. that's the number of months you should wait.
See, I heard that it was how long it takes to get over a breakup. Is that for every year you were together, it takes a month.
Maybe that was it. Maybe I just turned it into.
I've heard that as the year to a month.
But it feels like a good rule of thumb. So like they've been together 4 years. So technically he should have waited 4 months to see if she came out of the coma.
He waited 4 weeks. Now my question to you, Ron, is you've been with your wife how long? 8 years?
So altogether, it's been 10 years.
When you say altogether, what is that?
Like the time that we were dating prior to getting married.
Okay, 10 years. Say you and your wife are at the next Great Chefs of Philadelphia event.
Okay.
To the benefit, Alex's Lemonade Stand. Great charity. If you haven't gone there and donated money, say, you know, sometimes if you just feel like it, buy a ticket to the Great Chefs of Philadelphia and then don't go.
Yeah.
Don't go to the event. Just let the money just go to waste. It goes to a great cause. It's for sick kids. It's for the kids. So you're with your wife for 10 years. The two of you are at this Great Chefs of Philadelphia. You're eating your hoogies. You're drinking your water ice. And she falls headfirst off the garage, onto her head. She is in a coma in the hospital. How long until you move on? Are you telling me 10 months and you think it's okay to start dating?
I think it's different when you're married. I think you got to ride it out until
forever
until you have to pull the plug. I think
hold on a second. So you're telling me, Great Chefs event, your wife's been drinking, it's the fourth inning. She looks at you and says, honey, hold on. Ron, I want to go home. I'll go home, Ron. Then she goes right off the top of the garage, head first into the ground. You're telling me that because you're married, you would wait for her forever?
I think, I think the marriage-wise, I think that makes a bit of a difference. Because again, she's not dead. She's just, she's in a coma.
So 12 years go by, you're still just sitting at home waiting for her. You're feeding all the cats, you're feeding all the dogs. You're just 12 years from now, you're still waiting for
a lot of the pets, and I'm probably doing a lot of charity work, stuff like that to really fill my time.
I think you're lying to me. I think you're lying to me, Ron.
Anything else before we get out of here? It feels like we should wrap up and get ready for After Dark, which we have yet to even discuss the fact that you folks, if you are not already, need to join our Patreon. Go to ronandbrianpodcast.com. Go to the upper right-hand corner. Click on Become a Patron. If you subscribe at the bronze level or higher, that's only 10 bucks a month, you can join the live After Dark that takes place 9:30 on Sunday nights. The last Sunday of each month is our pajama party, where we allow our Patreon subscribers to come on the show live with us. You can also get some great swag. We've got new stickers coming out, so hopefully we'll have those not next week. Probably a week and a half, we'll have those new stickers. So we will be able to show those off. You can get coffee mugs. You can get baseball caps, shot glasses, our fridge magnets, the whole nine yards. We just got a lot of swag that you can get. But most importantly, access to the After Dark. So we're going to be doing that in about 16 minutes. So if you go right now and sign up for Patreon, we can get you that link and we can get you into After Dark. Brian, anything else?
Absolutely not. Thank you for joining. Be kind. This is a shitty world we live in, people. Try to do something to be kind to somebody else so that their world is less shitty.
Sounds good. Love you, my friend. Love all of you out there. And we will catch you all next week.
Thank you for joining us on the Ron and Brian podcast. We're live each week on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitch. You can find prior episodes, links to our social media, and everything else Ron and Brian at ronandbrianpodcast.com. See you again next week.